You're listening to Opacity, a podcast about working in design. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Tom. How are we today?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well on this sunny Wednesday morning in Dublin.
Yeah, it's a nice one, actually.
Is it sunny where you are?
Yeah, pretty sunny for Dublin.
It's actually cloudy.
It hasn't fully turned to autumn or fall, I suppose, for American listeners. Just yet, it doesn't feel like it. Everything's still pretty green. But I think, like most people, I do enjoy it when it kind of gets more orangey and stuff starts, leaves start to fall and that kind of thing.
Things don't really change that much here, though.
They do.
Like, compared to places where, like, so I'm from upstate New York, which is okay for fall colors. But the states, you know, Vermont and Massachusetts, you know, people would go up and drive and do their leaf peeping. At this time of year, I think this is like
leaf peeping.
It's driving the roads and looking at all the vibrant leaves.
Sounds kind of voyeuristic, actually.
Well, you're staring at leaves. So, it's a thing we do. So compared to that, well, I guess the Ireland, there's two things in Ireland. One is things don't really change that much color wise. And secondly, the whole year feels like it's autumn. Like, it doesn't, the Hibernia was what the Romans called Ireland, I think, which meant everlasting winter. I think it's more everlasting fall. Like, it's just always fall. There's like warm fall days, i.e. summer. There's cold fall days, i.e. winter. And then there's fall, which is spring and summer, or spring and autumn.
Yeah. We definitely don't get any extremes. It's usually kind of gray and stuff, but... Hey, I like it. I embrace the gray.
Is that true? Hibernia was from the Romans? You should fact check that. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I heard it when I arrived 3 years ago. I was on a walking tour of the city center. Oh, and that's nice. What the tour guide said, so it stuck with me.
Very good. You probably know more about it than I do.
Oh, I do, yeah.
It's the usual thing of, like, you know, someone who lives in their own town doesn't know all the things to see and all the interesting facts and stuff. But speaking of living in Dublin, you're doing a very Irish thing today, kind of.
Yeah, like an Irish kid. what age do you typically do this at?
Oh, it depends. It really depends. Some people don't learn to drive till ever, but you know, my understanding is in the States, it's a little, you usually do it a bit earlier, like you have driver's ed and that kind of thing.
Well, it's kind of, at least for me growing up, like it's like a thing, like you turn 16. And for us, it was like on your birthday, you go to the DMV and you get your learner's permit. And then, you know, you go from there. Wow. So that's, yes, I assume a lot of people do that. I don't know. That was my experience growing up.
Yeah, it's so vast, I suppose, that you kind of culturally, well, you need to be able to, you've got further distances to travel generally. So you need to be able to drive sooner, I'd imagine. Whereas in Ireland, small country, Dublin, small city, you can get around for your whole life without needing to drive at all, really, you know.
So yeah, I assume there's probably a different case in urban environments. Like if you live in Manhattan, I don't know who grows up in Manhattan, but if you live in New York City, let's say, maybe getting your license when you turn 16 is not as much of a thing. I don't know. If anybody's listening who grew up in New York City, tell us, did you get your license when you were 16?
So you're going to do the theory test today.
Yeah, right? So yeah, one of the trials and tribulations of moving to Ireland as an American is you can't, you can only drive on your U.S. license for a year technically. So I'm trying to get my Irish license, which means I have to go back to the beginning, take my theory test, get 6 hours of lessons. Because I have a U.S. license, I don't have to do all the things. Like, I don't have to wait 6 months to take a driving test. But
is it like being 16 all over again?
It's a bit stressful because I realized as I was studying for the exam is I haven't actually taken an exam in so long. Like, I feel like everything we do, you know, work-wise, like whatever, it's all like negotiable. There's no like right and wrong answer. It's all, you know, it's partly how you pitch it, and it's partly kind of like your interpretation. Everything's subjective. So it's it was a bit stressful to say, okay, now I have to go take this exam, and if I don't get enough marks, I'm going to fail, and then I have to go back and do it again. It's just kind of weird. Not to mention all the crazy questions, you guys, all these. Dipped headlights, turnabout. What are the words you guys use? Oh, all the signs with
roundabout,
flow.
Is it?
With flow. No, roundabout's fine. I get that. All right. With flow, bus lane. You know, taxis, cycles, and bicycles, and buses can drive in that lane. What about the contra flow bus lane? What do you call it? Zebra crossings, humpback, something. Oh my god, there's so much stuff.
Sounds like you're gonna fail.
I'm definitely gonna fail. I should be studying right now, but instead I'm recording this with you. So.
Yeah, it's I just kind of like read it and then I just like open pages, cover the answers, and I'll try and answer the question and see if I got it right over and over again. And I think it's out of 40. I think I ended up getting like 37 out of 40, which I surprised at, because I pretty much could nail anything at home. I could pretty much answer everything at the time. But
best of luck
with it.
Yeah, thanks.
Break a leg.
I don't have to. I mean, at home, I don't think anybody fails the theory test. Like, it's just something it's like a formality. You go and you answer 20 questions, are the easiest things ever, and you come out with a permit, and then you learn to drive. But this is stress inducing. So anyway, we'll report back next episode. I'll let you know if I passed.
Well, here's a pretty, like, I'd say wild fact, that years ago, not that long ago, really, you did the theory test and you passed that, and then you could kind of just get a provisional license. You could go and drive without properly doing lessons. You're kind of encouraged to do lessons, and then you went and did the driver's test. And if you fail the driver's test, you could drive home and just keep driving. You know, you could just, like, request to do it again. It was just... Yeah, not very kind of backward way of doing things. They're much more strict about it now, though, yeah.
Yeah, back in the good old days.
Back in the good old days. Well, best of luck with it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So I suppose we got to get on to our topic for today. Something that I've been kind of... I think I mentioned the last podcast that I've spent a spudge from work on books and stuff, and I'm trying to read more books and kind of educate myself a bit about things that... You know, I know some about, but I would like to know more about. And one of the books that I read recently is Accessibility for Everyone by Laura Kalbag. Mm-hmm. I think I'm pronouncing that. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And she makes loads of great points in it. Like, it's a really good book. And I think even for people who are pretty, you know, understanding of the needs of accessibility, it's just a really good book to read. It's very easy to read. So definitely recommend that. But one of the quotes that kind of stuck out in my mind and I've been kind of mulling around in my head is this one here. So Laura says, usability can be compromised when designers abandon conventions because we've decided to redefine, in brackets or quotes, how something is usually done. Very occasionally, this can result in a new innovation that genuinely redefines and reshapes behavior, but it usually just makes a really unique mess.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, definitely feel a lot of that. I mean, I think, like, designers seem to love a good redesign. Like, it's, I don't know, personally, I always find it kind of an exciting thing to propose and to get sort of green-lighted from the higher ups to say, yes, go forth and redesign this screen or this navigation or whatever aspect of the product you're working on. But yeah, it's always a push and pull, and it's always a bit messy. Like, even if it's a good redesign, it can be messy, I find, and sort of where it goes and how you put it out there.
Yeah, I find that a lot of design, like, there's a lot of discussion around this, and you see people kind of yearning for times long past where design, particularly with, like, web related design or digital products, was more experimental, was more creative, was more fun. And I can understand that, you know. I can understand that, you know. I remember back in the day, it was kind of a bit before I started, but, like, you know, flash websites, and people were just, like, being really creative. You know, I'll put that in quotation marks. Like, so it was very way of just, like, being creative and having fun and all that type of stuff. But, like, and at the time when I saw that stuff, I was like, that is really cool. How does that flash website work? It's kind of like I'm watching a little mini movie here, as opposed to working a website. But, like, they're kind of like, they're like a black box. They're not very usable, you know, from accessibility point of view. They were terrible. Like, you know, Flash was not very good for accessibility. It couldn't parse any information for someone who isn't just like regular sighted or any of those types of things. And so, to my mind, I always see this comes up every now and again, and people do talk about it. And in my mind, I think when, like, earlier in my career, I'd be kind of like, oh yeah, I want to do something exciting. I want to do something interesting. But I suppose maybe the more experience I get and the more, you know, I work in, especially with like enterprise software, and understand the wide breadth of users that we have, and the different abilities that people have, it changes my view on some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, I think it also comes down, because we have this discussion. It comes up all the time. You know, somebody will share like this super interesting flashy website with all this crazy stuff going on, and sort of there'd be one of two perspectives. Either like, look at this amazing work, isn't this great? And the other is like, look at this terrible website. They just make everything flashy, and I don't know what's going on. I can't use it. And like, those seem to be the two archetypes, or at least two main archetypes of designers out there.
Yeah.
Which is, but it's like, what are you actually building? And if you're building a flashy website that's supposed to, you know, maybe align more with some kind of crazy brand and like whatever, like that's the thing you're doing. And maybe that wild, largely unusable website, even, you know, you could probably get around, but it might be really hard. Like, but that's not their priority, because that's not the thing they're building. Whereas I feel like for a lot of our work, especially like me and you, Tom, who are, you know, building enterprise software, like, but I really, anyone building tools, like building tools for users who need to accomplish a task, like obviously the game shifts, like, yeah. So you have to know what you're building and why you're building it. And, you know, I think find like also, to make things fun, like sometimes you can look at enterprise software particularly and sort of maybe feel like it's not the most exciting type of design work to be, because it can maybe be a bit dry and it's a bit bland, and you know, there's all kinds of complications with it. But you can sort of fall in love with some of the problems and some of the messiness of it, that you have to it's making sense of complexity and all of that becomes interesting, as opposed to like these more flashy kind of expressions of design. So it's a very different world, I feel like.
Definitely, yeah. I think if you're trying to build something or design something that people use for their day-to-day work or to get a task done, it's almost more like, you know, designing and building some kind of like transport structure or something, you know, within a city. It might not be as big and sexy, but it has a function to do, and it's a very important function, and people need to use it, people need to rely on it. People can't walk up to the doors of this tram and not understand how to open it. That's a failure, you know. Yeah. But it could have this really cool interface that's flashing, and you know, it's very animated. You're like, well, this is no use to me. It looks nice, but if I can't use it. Now, I know we're talking about extremes there. I think there's a balance to be had, but you mentioned something about menus, and I think you said something about a game as well. And you just triggered something that from a recent game that I've been playing, and which I had this issue with. There's a game called Death Stranding. It's from Hideo Kojima. He made like Metal Gear Solid and stuff, or his team did. So I was interested in playing this new game, but there's loads of things. Like, it's quite out there, but one of the things that really bothered me about it was the menu structure. So when you go in, there was lots of these unconventional things. I really didn't know what was going on. And like, I'm a designer, I design menus, I'd be pretty savvy. I've played games for years and stuff. And it just kept, there's loads of things that were wrong with the fonts were way too small. Mm-hmm. The menus just didn't really make any sense to me. They were kind of like, there was a novelty element to them. And it really took away from, it actually just compounded my kind of, what's the word? My frustration maybe with the game in general as well, because it's a very strange game. But I wanted to give it a go, but this was like, even just the practicalities of this menu stuff was just like driving me, it was just pushing me away. And it wasn't even that creative, it was just messy, do you know? Like, it wasn't even like they decided to completely remake something that looks amazing or anything. It just was ticking all the wrong boxes, or unticking the boxes it should be ticking. And so it's not even just enterprise software. Like, this is a game. This is entertainment, and trying to do something unconventional is this. It failed in this point for me anyway. It was a real failure, because the thing about games is, and menus and the controls and all, is that it needs to become second nature. It needs to become like muscle memory very quickly. You know, if you play a good game, you don't even think about what you're doing. You're just hitting these buttons, these combinations of buttons, or, you know, swapping weapons or whatever it may be. And I think, like, I've got a lot of love for game designers. They blow me away. But it's funny when you see this, it's just kind of like, it just seems like it fell flat, like, for unnecessarily, you know?
Like, in our world, and it's not only enterprise software, I think any kind of, whether it's consumer or enterprise, like, building of tools that do things for people, you know? I guess, where are the areas that things like accessibility and usability are less relevant? Like, is that a question worth asking?
Within enterprise, like, or just in general? Like,
just in general, enterprise. Like, building, I guess, designing tools to do things, you know, is things that, like, accessibility and usability, does it cover everything, like the whole gamut from soup to nuts? Is that what they say? Everything must be sort of this accessible standard, or is it just hitting the big things, hitting the navigation, hitting make sure your content is well done or well written? I don't know. Like, where are the areas for creativity, I guess, in our world?
Yeah, I think my perspective on this is that things should be as enjoyable and easy to use for everyone as possible. So I think if it's your own personal website or something, I think we're all very guilty of that. You know, that our websites that we put together probably aren't great, like, from an accessibility point of view. And I don't think, you know, I think I'm gonna try and improve mine, but I don't think that's the worst thing in the world, like, because we don't have a high volume of traffic and stuff, right? But I do think in everything that we do, it's like, it's fundamentally what is good design, you know? Like, if we're creating digital things, well, then it's not just people who have just, like, standard, normal vision, you know, can use a mouse and the usual things that most people do. Like, that's kind of an immature way of looking at it. Like, oh, well, we're looking after them, and we're not looking, you know, we don't really mind about anyone else. Like, to my mind, it's kind of like, yeah, if you're building a building and you've got just steps outside and you're limiting people who are in wheelchairs or would benefit from a ramp, which would be most people, I think, you know, that's bad design, basically. Do you know? So if you're doing something digital, I think we need to think about everybody as much as we can, cater for their needs as well.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to think is, like, where does creative work, and it's probably its own can of worms to get into. So, like, okay, let's say, all right, your icons are recognizable, your color contrast, your entire palette is, you know, meeting the highest standard. Your layout is, like, following conventions and sort of an understandable layout. Things that need to be clickable appear to be clickable. Things that are not clickable do not appear to be clickable. Like, all of those checkboxes, right? Like,
but then you got screen reader stuff as well. Like, what's informative iconography versus decorative and that kind of thing as well. What is the screen, basically, screen reader saying is on the screen, on the page in front of the person?
Yeah. So, I mean, at the end of the day, when all those boxes are checked, which are really kind of accessibility and usability or usability boxes, what's left? What is there more work that we have to do, or is that everything? Like, is that the whole
kit and go home? Yeah.
Like, once all those boxes are checked, like, have you designed? Like, is that good design? And if so, like, why is design a creative industry, creative field, if it's all just checking accessibility boxes or usability boxes? And I'm on the side of accessibility, usability first and foremost. But I think it's a good thing to think about.
Yeah, you're prompting conversation. Yeah, cool. I don't think it's ever done. You know, design, especially for digital products, isn't ever done. And I get where you're coming from, and I've heard people make this kind of thing before, this argument before, or this. Yeah, like this discussion before. And I think it just, for me, it kind of comes down to, it's fundamentally the difference between design and art. And it sounds, you know, that might sound obvious to people, but I really don't think, I think a lot of people who are more on the creative in quotes side of things, like they think things should be creative and interesting and all. There's a constant tension between stuff that's artistic and useful. And people who are artistic tend to, it's a defining part of their character. Things, everything they touch needs to have this certain level of creativity or trying to push the boundaries, even just to keep them interested, you know, to make it interesting. They see it completely boring. Why would I make the same thing as that other person? And you're like, well, okay, I'm not saying don't try and think outside the box or whatever, but why reinvent something fundamentally? You see this all the time with stuff like, bathrooms, certain ways of triggering water, certain ways of triggering soap, or you might even see these kind of conceptual ones where you don't see anything until you come up and then things start moving and appearing. And, you know, it's kind of like, that's interesting. And if that's for a homeowner who's been explained, oh, this is how this thing works, then that's fine. But for the general public, it's not good design if someone walks up to something and they don't know how to use it.
Yep.
So it might not be creative. It might not be interesting. It might seem boring to that person. But if it has a job to do, it doesn't need to be anything else. Like, it needs to hit those things at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a level of, you know, I know the term kind of delight gets thrown around. If that's on top of it, great. But it's not at the expense of people understanding how to use it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like what I have, the image in my mind right now is this Venn diagram. And maybe it's, you know, a lot of us in product design, UX, whatever, we work a lot with engineers, or at least we should work a lot with engineers, right? Mm-hmm. And I find a lot of times in my interactions with engineers how much... and I think maybe this has changed over the years, but how much we speak the same language, it's just that the manifestation of how we then go do our work is different, right? Theirs is in code, ours is in screens and whatnot. Mm. I feel like there's a Venn diagram here of, like, imagine, like, sort of, let's say visual design maybe on one side and then engineering on the other side. And the overlap of those feels like sometimes... it's just a premise, but it sort of feels like that's where we live, because there's aspects of our work that is visual, but there's aspects of our work that feels closer to engineering. I mean, it feels like, obviously we're not, like, we are engineer, like a lot of the decisions that a designer makes are like small e or lowercase e engineering the product, right? You're saying how it's going to work, and then the engineer builds.
Is it more
that,
like,
right?
Architecture?
Yeah, maybe.
Than engineering?
Maybe it's architecture. I don't know. But I feel like, you know, and then within that spectrum, you know, designers, some obviously lean more to the visual side. Some maybe lean more to the architecture or engineering side. Some sit right in the middle, some whatever. Yeah. But I wonder if, like, just kind of thinking through that and seeing if there's something there, like I've been thinking a lot about this kind of over the years of, like, is the design that we do actually a creative field? And I think this accessibility topic of, you know, making sure it's accessible, making sure it's usable, making sure it's functional, whatever. Like, those are things that are just as much owned by engineering as it is by designers. Mm-hmm. And they don't, to me, they don't feel like creative, necessarily capital C creative types of things to be working on. Mm. Like, that's a whole nother, like I said, a bag of worms. But, I'm just rambling. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it is really interesting. And I don't know if I have I think we're just discussing it now.
Don't have the answer to my non-question.
To your non-question here. But the more you're talking about there, I was just kind of thinking around, like, most of the time when we're talking about things, we're referring to, like, the digital realm. Mm-hmm. But what you were just saying there, I was just picturing, you know, like, architect and a builder. And it's kind of it's a similar kind of thing with, you know, designers are more like architects and developers are more like builders. Mm. And the thing about builders is they have to be really grounded in reality. And I think that there's a tension there between designers and engineers a lot of the time when designers bring things too much away from reality. So they're thinking logically, systematically, how is this going to work? How are we going to build these things that it will be structurally sound? Yeah, I get I love your sketches. They're lovely. They look amazing, right? But how is that going to work? The balance of that will throw this thing off, blah, 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 X, Y, and Z. Not to say that can't be done. Look at, like, the Sydney Opera House. Like, they wouldn't have buildings like that without the vision and, I don't know what that relationship was like when they were building that, but, you know, there needs to be, there's a, there's, there's, um, there needs to be a fundamental reality check, and that's what engineers and builders and stuff bring to it. Mm-hmm. So like I've got some friends in that work in trade, and they would be, you know, carpenters and that kind of thing, and they'd often kind of sneer at stuff that the architect would specify, just like mm-hmm. because it's just like, it's a picture you drew, abstract away from this is how they would frame it, like,
yeah.
But in reality, when you're actually there, you're like, well, we don't have that space to put that thing there. How's that going to go there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a constant tension between creative and the building type of roles, I think, in general, across fields.
Yeah, and to kind of build on that analogy, it sort of feels like, so you have the architect, which does feel like what we often embody, the builder. And then on the other side of the spectrum is, I guess, the interior designer, right? Like the architect is, I assume architects don't say the walls should be this color. Mm-hmm. This plant should be over here. Here's where the artwork's going to hang. Maybe they have some input on that, but like probably it's not really a lot of their concern. Yeah. And so that sort of feels accurate, right? Like whereas like our purely visual designers, or maybe people who are really focused on, I mean, I don't know, the spectrum of UI that's closer to visuals, you know, sort of represent that interior designer kind of end of the spectrum. I don't know.
Totally.
I'm sure someone's made this analogy. Like, it's probably...
Yeah.
It's probably...
Well, it's a logical one. I think it does make sense, but like, and it sounds... I think visual design and interior design can be kind of dismissed sometimes as being mm-hmm. like, oh, you know, it's just kind of like the icing on the cake type thing. The you know, right, that's not the right... analogy, but as being is not it, as important
is because... is it a higher, like, I get part of me thinks yes, there is a hierarchy of importance here, whereas like the building has to be built structurally sound so it doesn't collapse on people. Okay, that's the highest priority. Second priority is they have to be able to walk in the door, they have to be able to, like, the floor has to be there has to be a place to know how to move in the space. And the last thing, which is essentially the kind of the experience of really being in the space, is probably the interior designer. Because if you walk into an empty room, like, it could be the perfect size, it could be the ceiling could be great, whatever, but like if it's empty and it's just like plain white walls with nothing in it, like that's not particularly nice. So
totally. I mean, like, if the analogy we're using there, like, it's almost like a hotel, right? So if you go in and depending on the decor, like how it's decorated, can make you feel completely different about it, you know? So mm-hmm. It could be, if it feels really cheap, if it feels plain, like, it's going to feel empty. You know, some people might like that, but I think the vast majority of people will walk in and go, oh, this looks unfinished. Mm-hmm. This is, I probably shouldn't stay here. Whereas if someone has put a certain level, it's kind of brand related as well, I think, depending on the brand, you know, what your brand approach is, and, you know, it should be kind of clear. That's a good opportunity of explaining the quality and the kind of approach and your kind of mm-hmm. you know, the brand you're going for. So if you come into a hotel and everything feels, you know, very opulent mm-hmm. and you know, lush and all that type of stuff, it's going to tell you something about the hotel, and probably going to tell you something about the price tag as well on renting the room. Whereas if you strip things back, if you're more minimal, or if you're kind of a lower economy level type of thing, well, then you can't really expect to pay less. And so I think it is really important, because the structure could be exactly the same. You could have two clones of buildings that are side by side, and it's just the attention to detail and the approach of the interior design that makes one feel like you want to stay there and the other doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good analogy for user interface design or visual design. Mm-hmm. If you open up a web page or open up a product and it feels sloppy or unfinished, you don't trust it as much, you know, as something that kind of feels together. It's kind of like, as an extreme level, I suppose, it's kind of like turning up at a shop and the sign outside is all rusty and dirty and the sign is falling off. You probably won't go in at all, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think this analogy also kind of drives home the whole idea that everybody owns the experience, like everybody from engineering to visuals and everything in between, own that experience, and or should be owning that experience to make sure that it's optimal from every level or every depth or whatever, however we're thinking about it. Yeah. So one kind of maybe last point from my side is, I feel like, you know, I think this analogy makes sense for me, but a lot of times maybe the designer is sort of expected to play the role of architect and interior designer. And some do. I think some are good at both those roles, but they are distinct roles in a lot of ways. You know, like for me, I feel more in this analogy fit more with the architect side of things. Mm-hmm. I will dip my toe in the interior designer's work. I'll have opinions on the color they chose, or the opinions on the vase that they put on the table. But like, those opinions are just sort of more reactive than like in terms of actually generating those ideas about what they should be. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, is it good that a lot of designers will encompass, especially in smaller teams, will encompass both of those spaces. And then sort of balance between them, because, you know, like for us, a lot of times, like, so that the flows that a user needs to go through, like those are fundamental, and making sure those are designed well is like, mm-hmm. is essential. But really what's seen when you put it out there and what's commented on from others is often the interior design, right? Like it's yeah. the visuals. It's like, you know, I don't like this color, or I think this, whatever, like the comments are typically, especially maybe in like maybe less mature groups, but really not, like really everybody like always has comments on those things because they're immediate, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So sometimes do people trade off some of the good design in terms of properly designing out workflows and things in favor of visuals? So the walls are built with the worst material, but like it's got some like nice gold plated candle holder on the table or like whatever, you know.
Yeah, or there's not enough doors, or there's like there's no window, there's no light in the room, yeah, but it looks, yeah. but the wallpaper looks great. Yeah. I do think that is obviously something that needs to be considered, because you can't really trade off. Like the fundamental thing is people need to be able to get in, need to understand, navigate around, do the tasks they need to do, and then on top of that is the layer of the polish. You know, I'm not saying it's not important; it's very important. Like it's a difference between someone wanting to use your product and not wanting to use your product. And that's like, that's obviously the language, the words, content strategy, all that type of stuff as well. Like it needs to all be, lots of stuff needs to be in place for something mm-hmm. to be desirable and something you want to come back to.
Yeah.
And I think on the point that you're saying that, like, I think it's okay to have specialists. People can be specialists. I think my personal take on this is that people, if you were an architect only and you never do any interior design, you still should educate yourself. You still should understand. You still should have a shared vocabulary with mm-hmm. the designer. You should still, as the architect, have a shared vocabulary, or the Venn diagram overlap, as you were mentioning, mm-hmm. with the engineers or the people who are building it. Like you can't. You may never do that. You may never pick up a brick. Mm-hmm. You may never, you know, lay down a floor. But you need to understand that if you're instructing someone that this is kind of how stuff needs to be, mm-hmm. then you need to understand that. There needs to be that shared vocabulary and that shared understanding. And whether it's just purely theoretical and you never roll your sleeves up, you know, that's mm-hmm. fine.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do think it's part of the job to be able to talk to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. My last thought go on. Is, and kind of bring it back to my first response to when you read the quote was about redesigns and getting excited about redesigns. It'd be nice, and maybe there are designers who are like this, that we get as excited about, let's say, quote unquote, redesigning like the accessibility or the usability of a product, mm-hmm. As excited about that as like redesigning like visual styles or just kind of surface level stuff, you know. Yeah. The surface level stuff can seem really fun, but like what if you have like a project that kicks off to like really properly, let's say you've built a product, you've moved too fast, you've cut a lot of corners, now it's time to like quote unquote redesign the accessibility of the product. Like mm-hmm. that should be really exciting for designers, right? And maybe it is.
I think so. But, yeah. I think it's another level of maturity on top of the designer. Not top of the designer, but I think it's like someone mentioned to me before. I can't remember how they mentioned it, but there's like different levels of designer. Like you're a level one designer, and you're interested in those, like the surface level things, and the level two things. It's a more mature approach where you're kind of thinking, you know, this stuff is important. Like this stuff mm-hmm. is essential, you know, like I'm feeling that right now. I'm doing a lot of accessibility related stuff in work, and I get a real buzz out of it because it's making me feel. It's changing the way I think about things. It's also, I know it has a bigger impact on whoever's using it, you know, mm-hmm. and even if it's stuff that's invisible, it still makes a difference. And you mm-hmm. can do both. One last thing, just
the never
just bring it back to the gaming thing. Yeah. So The Last of Us 2 came out this year, and it's, yeah, I think from what I've seen, it's the most accessible game. So it's a, and it's an amazing game. I know it's actually been very divisive for the story, but the game is incredible in my perspective. Like, it's a masterpiece, but also it's the most accessible game. Like, so there's loads of features in there. They haven't compromised in the game, and like, they've made an amazing game, but it's also the most accessible. Mm-hmm. So there's loads of stuff that people can do. Loads of things that wouldn't just rely on like visual cues, as in you being able to see where someone's saying, pointing an arrow or whatever, or saying over there, there's an arrow now that shows you kind of where it's talking about. Little things of this that don't take away from the game at all. If anything, they enhance it and make it easier for, make it, you know, better for everyone. Mm. And then you can add extra layers of accessibility settings on top of that as well. So I think that's a really good example of like in my mind, a masterpiece that's designed. It's all, it's entertainment. It, there's art in there, obviously, and but it's also hasn't compromised on making it accessible for everybody.
That's great. Very good. Well, I don't have any more points. That's the last
one. All right, let's wrap it up then.
All right, thanks, Tom. Cool. Good chat. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good chat.
All right, talk to you next time.
See you later.
Bye.